there's this sort of pink bear who has a really complicated motivation throughout the movie. It's not clear if he's good or bad, and he's pretty much bad, but you know, you don't want to destroy, you don't want to kill anyone in a Toy Story movie, and so they don't. They come up with this other way to redeem him. But I just wondered if any kid would. I appreciate the attempt at depth there and complexity on part of characters, but I just wondered if any kid would follow this at all.
Or anyone would be moved by it. I mean, you know, far be it for me to say we don't need backstories for our characters, because I do want depth, but I didn't think that we needed his backstory.
What's the most resilient parasite? An idea. A single idea from the human mind can build cities. An idea can transform the world and rewrite all the rules. Which is why I have to steal it.
Maybe, but not right now.
Come on.
Never recreate from your memory. Always imagine new places.
Return of the Astro Net.
He's hiding something, and we need to find out what that is.
Don't you get it? We're finished, obsolete, over the hill.
We gotta break out of here. In the kick.
Insert paperclip.
Use your paperclip. This was not a part of the plan.
Now, come on, guys. We all knew this day was coming.
We're getting thrown away.
No, no one's getting thrown away.
We ain't ever getting played with.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, Jay Robert.
How are you?
Pretty good.
Well, we're here to talk about some of the big summer movies.
Right. oh, yeah, I was supposed to start this. Christopher Nolan has a new one. Now, he's the guy who made Memento and Following, which everyone knows.
Yeah.
Christopher Nolan has a new movie out, and something about this guy really gets his fans excited, and yeah. He seems to have a lot of them. The newest one called Inception is now listed as the third best movie ever on the IMDb, as voted by the users of IMDb.
Yeah.
And I believe my guess is that The Dark Knight is one or two.
Yes, I think that's probably fair.
Along with Citizen Kane or something.
And like Shawshank that. Redemption, I think.
I don't mean to laugh. I like those. I like all the movies we've just mentioned. However, there yes, are
no hate mail, please.
There are but let's have some perspective. For example, let's talk about Inception. We've both seen this movie. What did you think?
You know, I don't like it as much as everyone else does, and that's, I'm going to try not to sound like some sort of killjoy, because I think there's a lot of good things about it. And actually, for a while, I was enjoying it. You know, it's a movie about dreams, and for some of you who are listening who actually haven't seen it, then, you know, and how can you be an American and not have seen this film? No, seriously, but it's a film about dreams, and it's a film about Leonardo DiCaprio's character is this guy who sort of is able to penetrate into people's dreams and sort of steal secrets out of people's minds through their dreams. But then there's this idea that comes place, and about maybe a third of the way through, to actually sort of try to plant an idea in someone's head and to go into their dreams and do that. And so it's all about, you know, corporate espionage. And it seems like there's been a lot of movies lately about this idea of corporate espionage. I guess real villains are maybe a little too scary or a little too remote. And so it's, you know, what can big bad corporations do to us or to each other? But for me, the film is the best when it's sort of conjuring this dream, these dream worlds that Leonardo DiCaprio and his team of, partners, assassins, I mean, they're not assassins, but they sometimes feel that way. This team that he's accumulated around him with people like Ellen Page and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. When they go into the dream worlds, the way that Christopher Nolan constructs those, I find those really fascinating. And particularly, there's an early scene where Ellen Page is somehow someone who can construct dream worlds. And so she and Leonardo DiCaprio go into this world and they get a sense of what it's like. And there's a real sense of wonder about it. And if you've seen the trailer for Inception, pretty much most of the trailer is taken from that sequence. But as the movie goes on, I found myself getting a little bit more and more bored. We were talking a little bit before we started recording about how, you know, the movie sort of owes a lot to video games, and particularly the idea of levels of video games, you know, in the sense that what happens is they have to go deeper and deeper and deeper. And so they are going dreams within dreams, and then dreams within dreams within dreams, and so forth and so on. And as that kept going on, it felt less and less interesting to me. And I got the sense that, and particularly once we get to this last one, which is this strange, I don't know, a snow mountain where people are skiing, and it's some weird cross between, you know, the Hoth sequence of Empire Strikes Back and a weird, very bad James Bond film.
For your eyes only.
Yeah, exactly. I just found myself getting bored, and it felt bloated to me. And there's a lot more to say to it, but that was disappointing that this, what I thought was going to be a really interesting world construction, you know, what is it like to go into someone's dream, ends up being a bad action movie. What do you think?
I agree with a lot of that. There are several key concepts that I think they came up with, and it's interesting how they sort of locked them together. Mm-hmm. One is this idea that you can go into dreams, but also this idea of shared dreaming. Mm-hmm. So two people can sort of hook up and they are in one person's subconscious, but the other person can be there interacting with their dream self and interacting with their dream world. This idea of dreams within dreams is powerful. Mm-hmm. And partly because it gives you more time to do things, because when you enter it, as we all know, whenever you're dreaming, a short period of time passes in the real world, but it feels like a long time in your dream. Well, according to the film, if you then have a dream within that dream, it's compounded. So yeah, it's sort of like exponential. And if you went two or three levels down, you could spend years or decades even in this dream thinking you're spending this time in all this time in a dream, when really in the real world you're not. It's just a few minutes or seconds even. And the danger in this is actually kind of interesting, the way the movie explains it. It's that you could live decades, you could live almost an entire lifetime in a dream, and then when you wake up, be dissatisfied with it. Mm-hmm. Because now you're back to some lesser life.
Yeah, a boring reality.
It's a boring reality, and not just boring, but it's like you've erased all accomplishments and bonding and everything that you thought you had.
Yeah.
And there's a key part of this, Leonardo DiCaprio's wife, and he did this with his wife, and she couldn't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. She knew that where they were wasn't real, and so they had to come back. And yet, when they came back, she couldn't cope with that either. And so this is the sort of the psychological center of the movie. Mm-hmm. And I think there is something interesting about all of these ideas and the way they interlock. And yet, it does feel very somewhat cold and mechanical. You mentioned this snow level. Mm-hmm. There's this the last maybe third of the movie is an action sequence, basically. And it's played out in three different dream levels at once. Somehow they went in as a team into this one guy's subconscious, mm-hmm. and they sort of split up and they're acting simultaneously on these multiple levels. And we cut back and forth between them as if they're different locations on the globe, but really they sort of affect each other in some ways.
Yeah.
And this feels really mechanical.
Yeah.
You know, every time we jump back to the snow, it's like it's a pointless, faceless, nearly faceless gun battle.
Yeah.
And they're shooting projections of people, and it does feel like a video game where they're sort of endless. They just keep coming, you just keep shooting them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and by that point in the film, it's become fairly clear to me, at least, two things. One is Leonardo DiCaprio is not going to die. I'm not going to give this away, but, and so therefore there's no real sense of danger on the snow level. We're just waiting for it to end. We know this is the last level. And you're just sort of waiting for it to play out. But it goes on a long time. But the second thing that also becomes clear, at least it did to me by that point in the movie, is that this has become another Christopher Nolan trick movie, you know, sort of like Memento, sort of like The Prestige, where I know there's going to be some kind of twist. There's a couple of different twists it could be, and so I'm not going to give this away for those of you who haven't seen the film, although we might have to talk about the ending. But I'm just sort of waiting for the twist to come. And that, to me, is not terribly satisfying, knowing that we've, you know, this really multivalent world, and where you could go in a whole lot of different directions, is going to come down to who's really dreaming. You know, that's the trick. The trick is, obviously, we're not in the dream that we thought we're in. I'm not, and that's not a surprise to me. I'm just sort of waiting to find out whose dream it is. Whereas the trick in Memento, I thought, was a lot more interesting, a lot more, it had a lot more depth to it, shall we say. You know, you talk about the relationship with Leonardo DiCaprio and his wife, who's played by Marion Cotillard. Thank you. As being the emotional center, and I know it's supposed to be, but I also don't particularly care at that point. I'm not sure why I don't. I think in part because I'm sort of caught up in all the action sequences, and I'm caught up in the trick. Whereas in Memento, with Guy Pearce sort of trying to piece back together his life, that felt like a real depth to it. A real power that, you know, even if there's sort of a trick to it, this idea of sort of going backwards, still had real resonance.
You know, what I liked about that trick was that it's very aware of how movies work.
Yeah.
The story of Memento takes place in normal time. Right. Why do we see it in reverse? Because that's how movies work. Every shot you see is built upon the sequence of shots that you saw before it. Yeah. Well, what if you reverse that? You have nothing before it. Therefore, it imitates, it's a simulacrum mm-hmm. for having no short term, having no memory yeah. of anything. And right. so it put you into the mind of the character in a really weird way yeah. and very clever, really yeah. clever. Where I agree with you that this does feel like a trick. And it makes me think that Christopher Nolan is a very clever story writer, mm-hmm. screenwriter. Not a great filmmaker necessarily. Mm. There's not a lot in Inception that really feels like it's harnessing the power of film. You know, I think sometimes you see a movie like this and it feels really mind-blowing if you haven't really seen a lot of movies that don't. I mean, there are movies that don't need narrative, for example. Or that, I think of Syndromes in a Century, a movie that I loved from a couple of years ago by Joe... Pichapong Wirasthikul yeah. from Thailand. His new movie just won the Palme d'Or at Cannes earlier this year. I haven't seen it yet, but his previous movie, Syndromes in a Century, is almost has no story, and yet it has pieces of a life and pieces that are personal to him and pieces of a world, and you just don't expect it to work like a story. Mm. And this, you sort of do expect it to work like a story. It is a story, and so you're sort of waiting to see how they're going to put the pieces together, because they are going to put the pieces yeah. together. And their characters spend a lot of time putting pieces together, yeah. explaining to each other so that we can listen, you know, how things work.
And interminably so. I mean, you talked about Christopher Nolan being a really good screenwriter, and I think he is to a degree.
Yeah.
But yet the seams show in this film in really irritating yeah. ways to me. I mean, Ellen Page's character, her only purpose in this movie is so that Leonardo can talk to her. And explain what's going on, because it is a very complicated, you know, system yeah. that the movie constructs. And so, but Leo has to explain that, like, almost every third scene is him explaining something to Ellen Page about what is now happening or what is about to happen
yeah.
so that the audience can figure it out. Because without that, you know, sort of, you know, narrative exposition, we're going to be lost.
It isn't just the complicated things. It's stuff like, I need to see my kids again. You know, your grandkids. So we're like, okay, so that's his dad.
Yes,
and, you know,
yes.
So there are better ways to convey
yeah.
all these plot
yeah.
points.
Yeah, and it does, and it feels like it. You know, it routinely brings the movie to a screeching halt, so that we can now explain what the next, you know, 20 minutes of the movie are going to be, and that feels really clumsy to me.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, it feels clumsy to me, maybe because I kind of like Ellen Page as an actress, and so I was hoping there'd be more depth to her character. But her role, theoretically, in the film is that she's able to construct a dream world.
She's an architecture student.
Exactly. And that strikes me as a really interesting job.
Yeah.
You know, that's the sort of thing is like, ooh, I would like to know more about that. I would like to know more about, you know, how she's constructed this dream so that it actually works in some way.
Yeah.
But we get none of that.
No.
I mean, we have no idea what she's done Once she enters this film,
I can sort of see why they wouldn't pursue every tangent like that, because they would be an endless film. Sure. It's already two and a half hours.
True.
And it feels packed. But there are lots of, it does provoke technical questions like that. Like, how is it that all levels can hear music? You know, they have headphones on that's going to cue them to the time to leave.
Yeah.
And yet only one of them is affected by the change in inertia, or gravity, as they call it, in the other level. You know, that's like that doesn't permeate all layers for some reason. They probably have an explanation for that. Yeah. I just don't know what it was exactly, or why they chose to do it that way.
No, but I think those questions are what a lot of people like about Inception.
Yeah.
And it's when I see Inception as the number three movie on IMDb's list, I feel a bit alienated, because I suddenly realize that for a lot of people, the reason they go to films is not the reason I go to films. And right. I always have known that. And yet I'm reminded of it with real force in a movie like Inception, where people just go, oh, that was the best movie I've seen in years. And I'm thinking, why? Oh, it just made me think about all sorts of things. And I'm thinking, what sort of things did it make you think about? Well, I mean, you know, like the top is spinning at the end, and is it spinning or is it stopping? And I'm thinking, oh, that's not a very interesting thing to think about, at least for me.
It's a puzzle to think about. And people go to movies for different reasons,
sure.
And that's fine. It's good that there are different types of things for different types of people, and whatever you like, it's fine. But I agree. that disclaimer aside, I agree with you that it feels like it's reaching for something so much more than any of those little things, and yet that's what it has to satisfy, are the little interests. I actually like the thing about the top. What they've done is, it's natural. If you're going to be sharing dreams with people, or you're going to be in someone else's dream world, it would help to have some way to know and have your bearings to know whether you're in your dream or someone else's. And they all have this little token that they carry around with them, and it's secret to themselves. You started off by saying that this whole world is a little bit like video games. Mm. Well, this is a little bit like computer science. Mm. When you encrypt a message to send to someone, you know, on the internet or whatever, you encrypt it with a secret key, and you give someone else a public key that they can use to decrypt it, or vice versa. And it's this way of keeping a thing that only you know, that validates the world as you know it. Mm. And that's what they have here. They have, you know, one guy has a little a die.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a die that's weighted in a certain way, so that he's the only one who ever feels it. He never gives it to anyone else, because then they would know what it feels like.
Right.
That way, when he's in his dream, he can feel this. And if it feels right, he's in his own dream. Now, if you pursue this a little bit, it gets a little bit weird, because there's a moment where they're in a certain character's subconscious. They take his wallet and go to an elevator, and they're looking through his wallet. And I was thinking, now, wait a minute. His wallet exists independently of him in his dream. You can take objects from him, but he's not thinking about this wallet. Is it fully fleshed out? I want to look at all the things in this wallet to see if he knows precisely every detail in his wallet, and how were they able to lift it from him? I really don't know.
No.
But those are that's the level of questions we're talking about.
Right.
Before I saw Inception, I heard some people refer to it as Kubrickian.
Oh.
I don't see Kubrick in this movie at all.
No.
But it is curious to think that the last movie Kubrick made was Eyes Wide Shut, which is very much a dream movie.
Right.
Inspired by Arthur Schnitzler's novel, which is called Traumnovelle, the dream novel.
Yeah.
And that movie actually sort of functions like a dream.
Yes, it does.
And frustrates the hell out of people because of that, because it doesn't satisfy a lot of these very simple concerns.
Yeah. That movie has grown. I mean, I liked it a lot when it first came out. But I think about that movie a lot, Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
I think that movie has real power. Well, I'm a huge Kubrick fan, but yeah, to call Inception Kubrickian is to misunderstand Kubrick altogether.
Yeah. Well, plus all the naked girls in Eyes Wide Shut. I don't know if you even want to say this, but it matches my subconscious better than the one that Leonardo DiCaprio has. Marion Cotillard is always fully dressed.
Yes, yes, yes. But and her character, I think, is particularly frustrating, not because she's fully dressed, but because she clearly is supposed to be sort of this emotional touchstone in the film. And yet we never really connect with her. At least I don't. And that I guess this is what I find frustrating about. I don't mind that people like the film, because like you say, people can like films for different reasons, and that's fine. But wouldn't you sort of want a movie to find an emotional connection with what it's supposed to be, an emotional connection, rather than just wondering, you know, what happens when we take his wallet? You know, that kind of question seems a lot more superficial to me than what does it mean when a marriage falls apart because one person doesn't want to live in the real world? And that strikes me as a very profound question. But this movie doesn't really have any interest in that question. I mean, honestly, it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you think of Kubrick's 2001, a great science fiction film, my favorite of Kubrick's movies, he has worked out a lot of these details of this futuristic world also.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not his final concern.
Right.
His final concern seems to be about existence and why are we here and what's the nature of man?
Right.
I mean,
right.
Really big question.
Absolutely.
And those are the questions the movie provokes.
Yeah.
And we're here, I think the questions are primarily limited to the puzzle of the movie, which has its own appeal.
Sure.
But feels somehow less than it maybe wanted to be.
Yeah, I think that's right. And for me, even at that level, even if I say, okay, I'm going to appreciate the movie at that level, still it's a long film.
Yeah.
You know, it's 2.5 hours. It feels bloated to me. You know, and so... even at sort of a very simple filmmaking level, it feels like it's less than it could be.
Yeah.
Now, one movie, another big summer film that I know has provoked an emotional reaction in lots and lots and lots of people is Toy Story 3. I've had so many friends of mine who are, you know, in their 40s and they have teenage children or children who are getting ready to go off to college. And they go to see Toy Story 3 and they talk about weeping for, you know, hours after the film is done, that it touches them on some level. You don't have, I know, teenage children, but you have a young daughter. Did you find yourself emotionally moved by Toy Story 3?
I did by the end, the ending, which not weeping, but I felt touched by the ending which surprised me because I wasn't with the movie for its entirety until that point.
Okay.
I think this is almost the reverse of Up, their previous movie, which I loved partly because it smacked me in the gut fairly early on.
Okay.
And as Roger Ebert sometimes says, I think he's quoting someone else whose name I can't remember. You have to admit that you were the person in the theater. That movie hit me at a certain point in my life, certain things that were happening that seemed to fit with the movie really well, and it just came at the right moment, and it was perfect.
You're talking about Up.
Talking about Up.
Yeah.
Toy Story 3, for whatever reason, didn't. And so to me, it feels like a lesser movie.
Mm.
But when you say that people are touched by it, I do sort of feel that by the end, and it has nothing to do with my children. I have one of them, but she's not big enough to care about this kind of thing.
Right.
But it's all about nostalgia. It's like how I felt about my toys.
Yeah.
And it feels like I know that was the center of the first Toy Story. Also, this idea of guilt about not playing with your toys. It sounds funny, but this is I think it's a real feeling that kids have. I remember feeling that. It's pressed especially hard in Toy Story 3, and for some reason I think that makes it feel a little cheaper.
Because it's trying too hard?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm probably one of the very few people, or at least film critics that I know, who's never really taken to the Toy Story movies. They're certainly way down on my list of my favorite Pixar films, 1, 2, and 3. I don't dislike any of them, but I've always been a bit confused by the attraction that they have for people, because for me all the films feel like they try a bit too hard. They all feel like they sort of try to really push this button of nostalgia, what's it like when your kid is never going to be 3 again, or never going to be 6 again, or never going to be 18 again? You know, what's it like to be a parent and to sort of say goodbye to that moment of your life and realize, wait, I can't get that back anymore. I don't have kids of my own, but I've worked with kids now for 20 years, and I've had several kids that I've worked with for, 8, 9, 10 years, and then watched them go away to school or to college. And so I know that feeling somewhat. I felt that, a very sort of strange loss at knowing that, wow, I'm never going to really see this student that I've worked with for so long again. But yet still, the Toy Story movies have always felt manipulative to me in ways that irritated me. But I fully recognize that I'm the minority on that one, that for most people they have real power.
Well, they're very sentimental, as all the Pixar movies are, almost all the Pixar movies are.
Well, as most kids' films are.
Yeah, but I do appreciate that they're really, I think they're not just picking a character and trying to make you identify with them and take them through a roller coaster. I think they're really trying to think a little bit about how kids feel, and parents, people of different ages, I guess, like you're saying, and harness that feeling mm-hmm. that people have in their story. It just feels, I think maybe part of why Toy Story 3 felt like it was, as I said, pressing too hard on this central idea was maybe because it was repeated. Mm. It felt like a sort of an emotional template. The movie itself follows kind of a pretty different arc, I guess, from the first one, but the emotion at the end is very similar in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's why. It just mm-hmm. feels like, you know, they did it again is all. Mm-hmm. So it makes it seem easier.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know you haven't seen Despicable Me, but I saw that a couple of weeks after I saw Toy Story 3. And I strangely like that movie quite a bit more.
No, I don't know anything about this movie.
Yeah, it's an animated film made, I think, by the folks at DreamWorks. And so it's that, you know, the other major animated studio or animation studio. And it's a film about this supervillain, and he's kind of an older guy. Who was the big deal? He was the big supervillain, but now he's not. He's been eclipsed by sort of a cooler, although strangely nerdier. It's really interesting. The real villain in Despicable Me strikes me as pretty much a clone of Bill Gates, I find that really interesting. I'm not sure what I'd do with it, but it seems pretty obvious to me. But anyway, so our main villain, or the main hero, the eclipsed villain, wants to try to sort of do one last great, you know, villainy thing, which is that he's going to steal the moon and he's going to make it really small and steal it out of the sky. And that really, to be honest, is, it's not a MacGuffin, but it's not a very important part of the film. I mean, that really just sort of sets a plot in motion. The real center of the film is that, these three girls, these three orphaned girls, sort of in the long, great tradition of children's stories of three orphans who live in this horrible orphanage, and they have to sort of sell cookies to if they're going to eat. And then the but and so of course our villain it feels like I should call him a hero, but he's not. But anyway, our villain rejects them immediately. Of course, he's not going to buy their cookies, but then realizes that if he has these three girls, he can defeat his arch nemesis, and so he adopts them. With, you know, the intention of using them and then, of course, you know, sending them back to the orphanage. But, of course, I mean, it's very predictable. He finds that he really comes to have great feelings for them. And so there's nothing terribly new or interesting about the plot of this film. It's very paint by numbers in many ways. And its sentimentality is fairly obvious, as it is in Toy Story 3. And yet I find myself much more engaged with it. The relationship between the older man and these three girls seems genuinely real to me in ways that for some reason the relationship of the toys don't. I think, a much funnier film. The villain has these things that he calls his minions. And they're these little, I don't even know how to describe them, but because they don't really talk, but they sort of talk. And they're very little, and he's got dozens of them, and they're hilarious. Every time they're on screen, I laugh. If there was a TV show about the Minions, I would watch it. and the little girls are wonderfully adorable in ways that I don't find the toys in Toy Story to be so. And so I root for them, and I root for them to have this connection with this villain as a way of finding a better world and a better life. And so when it happens, I feel good about that in ways that I don't particularly care about. You know, I don't care at the end of Toy Story 3 that the toys get played with. I don't know what that says about me as a person, but I really don't care. And that for me.
You don't want them to end up in the attic, do you?
Well, I mean, they're eventually going to end up in the attic. I mean, so, but anyway, it's interesting. And I can't sort of give a rational reason really of why I find Despicable Me a lot more enjoyable, but I do.
I found that Toy Story 3 was really complicated too before it got to the sort of payoff point, and that was why it was just kind of, you know, checking my watch. There's this sort of pink bear who has a really complicated motivation throughout the movie. It's not clear if he's good or bad, and he's pretty much bad, but you know, you don't want to destroy, you don't want to kill anyone in a Toy Story movie, and so they don't. They come up with this other way to redeem him. But I just wondered if any kid would. I appreciate the attempt at depth there and complexity on part of characters, but I just wondered if any kid would follow this at all.
Or anyone would be moved by it. I mean, you know, far be it for me to say we don't need backstories for our characters, because I do want depth, but I didn't think that we needed his backstory. but then, I mean...
He's the tyrant who runs the world of toys at the...
daycare center.
The daycare center.
Yeah. Where the toys are sort of taken as their owner is about ready to go to college. And, you know, at first they think it's going to be this great place. They're going to get played with again. But then it turns out to be, you know, something out of Joseph Conrad's, you know, Heart of Darkness or something. But it's...
there are layers of, yeah, certain rooms are okay, certain rooms you don't want to be placed in. And this pink bear controls who goes, what toys go to what rooms now.
Yeah, it's...
He has a lot of bitterness. He's very bitter. And we get the whole story. We even get a flashback to explain it's very complicated.
We get a backstory, and there's no doubt about it. But it's, I want to clarify that I don't dislike the film. I was pleasant enough while I watched it. But I do find it, again, strange that so many people are so moved by it. And maybe if I had kids who were getting ready to go to college, I would. But I don't see it.
Don't you think Pixar they've become so reliable and yet so predictable?
Yeah.
And I know that they don't want to tarnish their brand, and everything they put out makes hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right.
And Disney did this for decades, and so why should they do anything different?
Right.
But don't you sometimes wish that those animators there had free rein to do something sort of crazy and totally different?
Well, and Wall-E does, though. I mean, for the
Wall-E
first half.
Wall-E branched out, but not very far.
It's for me, the frustrating thing about Pixar is that I can almost predict certain plot points. And it's pretty much inevitable that the movie will end with a chase sequence. And often how much I like the film depends on how short the chase sequence is. One of the reasons I don't like Up that much is the chase sequence just seems to go on forever. There's a long chase sequence in Toy Story 3 as well. Whereas in Wall-E, it doesn't feel as long to me. And the joy of that first half goes a long, long, long way.
Yeah, it is a much different movie, very different movie.
But I think you're right, though. I think most of the Toy Story movies tend to follow the same arc. They have the same sense of camaraderie. They have the same sense of conflict and how that conflict will be resolved.
And even the nature of storytelling, the way that the story is told, very, very traditional.
Yeah.
In the shorts that they do, you often see things that are very different.
Yeah.
I really liked Day and Night, the one that preceded Toy Story 3. It's in some ways a throwback to the Warner Brothers cartoons of the post-war era.
Yeah.
And yet in other ways, it's just, you know, visually really dramatic and interesting.
Yeah, no, I agree.